Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ryan, your host for the Radio Live Transmission Podcast. Welcome to today's episode. This is episode 8, and it is entitled Kings, Crosses, and Fools. On today's episode, we'll be giving you brief reviews of new releases from Accept, Doom Side of the Moon, and Vic Mensa. And then in the main event segment of today's podcast, myself and a special guest will be reviewing the new self-titled album from the band Dead Cross, and also Faith No More's classic album King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime. So why don't we get right into the reviews. First album I'd like to talk about today is the new album from the band Accept. The album is called The Rise of Chaos. It was released on August 4th. It's Accept's 15th studio album. Accept is a band that's been around for quite a long time. It was released on Nuclear Blast Records, and it was produced by a guy by the name of Andy Sneap, who's worked with bands like Opeth and Saxon and Amon Amarth, Megadeth, Exodus, Testament. The list goes on and on. The current lineup for the band Accept is, on vocals, a guy named Mark Tornillo, who was in a band called TT Quick, and he also sang vocals on the Overkill album White Devil Armory. On guitars is one of only two original founding members of the band, a guy by the name of Wolf Hoffman. Also on guitars is a guy named Uwe Lulis. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. On bass is a guy named Peter Baltes, who is the other only original member still in the group besides Wolf Hoffman. And on drums is a guy named Chris Williams. Now, The Rise of Chaos received a Metacritic score of 79 out of 100, which is considered generally favorable on the Metacritic scale, and that was calculated out of 4 reviews. So, The Rise of Chaos, it feels like a time capsule. You know, it sticks pretty closely to the style of heavy metal that bands like Accept played throughout the 1980s. The sound is still a sort of hybrid of AC/DC and Motorhead, with a flair for Iron Maiden-style dramatics, you know, sprinkled throughout the album. Also, lyrically, the album tackles a lot of typical metal themes, you know, such as mankind's destructive nature and tendencies on a track like the title track, The Rise of Chaos, the toll that war takes on the human soul and psyche on a track like Die by the Sword. There's even a take on the Jonestown mass suicide incident of the late 1970s, which is a track called Kool-Aid. The album even points to the current issue of climate change on the closing track, which is called Race to Extinction. I'd say that the one lyrical misstep on this album is the track Analog Man. Yeah, the premise of a guy who's accustomed to an analog age, you know, feeling lost in this current digital age of ours, has the potential for humor, but it's tough to tell just how tongue-in-cheek the band are being because they seem to play it so straight. The Rise of Chaos, you know, when all is said and done, is a pretty by-the-numbers 80s-style heavy metal album. Except don't really seem too interested in reinventing the wheel, only keeping it rolling. In a world where metal has become an overarching term for such a wide variety of nuanced subgenres, it's pretty tough to see Accept being relevant for much longer. I gave The Rise of Chaos a rating of 6 out of 10, and for suggested listening, check out the tracks Die by the Sword and Kool-Aid. Okay, the second album I'm going to talk about today is an album that is actually a side project of a guy named Kyle Shutt, who plays guitars in the metal-slash-hard rock band The Sword. And this is an album that's called Doom Side of the Moon, which is sort of pegged as a heavy metal-hard rock cover of Pink Floyd's classic album Dark Side of the Moon. This album was self-released, produced by Shutt as well. And a guy by the name of Stuart Sykes both engineered and mixed the album. It was released on August 4th. Aside from Kyle Shutt, The personnel on the album include two other members of the Sword, Brian Ritchie, who plays bass, and Jimmy Vella III, who plays drums. And on vocals is a guy named Alex Marrero, who is from the bands Brown Out and Brown Sabbath. A guy named Joe Cornetti is on keyboards, and he is from a band called Croy and the Boys. And a guy named Jason Frey plays the saxophone on the album, and he's from a group called Hard Proof. So basically the gist of how I felt about this record is that a more straightforward metal version of Dark Side of the Moon would have been more impressive to me. You know, too often these versions of the songs, you know, they stick too close to the original versions, you know, while at the same time leaving out important elements, you know, i.e., you know, a lot of the sampling that was on Dark Side of the Moon and some of the you know, the female vocals that showed up on the album. I can understand the sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't feeling that, you know, anybody would have, you know, trying to cover an album, a seminal album like Dark Side of the Moon. But, you know, Kyle Shutt and company, they had an opportunity to really make something fresh and exciting. And, you know, for the majority of this record, they don't achieve that. The only examples of, you know, sort of fresh takes on the material are the tracks Money and Us and Them. Those are the two spots where Shutt and Company do something a little bit different with the songs and sort of make you, you know, your ears perk up a little bit and say, hey, you know, this is actually interesting. This doesn't sound like, you know, just an imitation of Pink Floyd's version. So I really hope that if Kyle Shutt, you know, decides to take on any more projects like this one, like Doom Side of the Moon, that he spends a little bit more time coming up with a unique vision of the material for, you know, for that release. So I gave Doom Side of the Moon a rating of 5 out of 10. And for suggested listening, check out the tracks Money and Us and Them. All right, so for the last brief review of today, we're going to and this is my personal pick for this episode. It's the album The Autobiography by Vic Mensa. It was released on July 28th. On Rock Nation and Capitol Records. It's Mensa's first full-length release. He had released two EPs previously. The executive producer on the album was No ID, and some of the producers, you know, on the tracks themselves are Mensa himself, Mike Dean, Pharrell, The Dream, etc., etc., etc. So, and the Autobiography received a Metacritic score of 71 out of 100, which is considered generally favorable, and that was calculated out of 12 reviews. Alright, so one can tell from listening to the Autobiography that Vic Mensa is definitely a versatile artist, and this is an ambitious first full-length album here. Ultimately, the Autobiography is messy. It's a messy affair. It misses the mark, not as often as it hits. Not really enough to detract much from my enjoyment of the album, but it does force me to skip a couple of tracks here and there, which is pretty rare for me. Mensa has a solid flow for the most part, and he can sing well enough to carry a chorus. The production on the album is also noteworthy, especially because of its variation in mood and tempo, and there's a lot of sprinkles of color on the album. There's a lot of really cool electric guitar licks that are thrown in here and there to sort of for sort of extra color on the record. But unfortunately, instead of integrating his multiple talents into a more focused attack, you know, Mensa kind of ambles around the Autobiography, you know, rarely landing anywhere solid for long. For every interesting track, you know, like the opener, which is called Say I Didn't, and the following track, which is called Memories on 47th Street, there's a dud, you know, not far off. Like the track Rolling Like a Stoner, and, you know, the less than stellar track, Gorgeous. Mensah is at his best when he gets confessional, like on the track Wings, or sentimental, like he does on the track Heaven on Earth. And he can even show a potential for humor on a track like Homewrecker. But this sort of scattershot approach, it sort of comes to a head on the closing track, which is called We Could Be Free, on which, you know, a message of solidarity, you know, comes through pretty strong. But the delivery of the vocals seems oddly flat to me. And, you know, that kind of takes the wind out of the sails for that particular song. So while the message comes through loud and clear, the delivery sort of, like I said, it sort of kills the momentum of the album. As a hip-hop record, the autobiography falls, you know, somewhere on the middle of the spectrum. Not quite commercial, or something that could be considered alternative hip-hop. See, if Mensah can focus his attention on fine-tuning his approach, then the results could really be something special. So I feel like he's almost there. And I do feel that he's talented enough and he takes an interesting enough approach, you know, that even though there are two or three tracks on this album that I would skip over, the rest of the material is good enough for me to make this album my personal pick of the week. So I gave the autobiography a rating of 6 out of 10. And for suggested tracks, check out Memories on 47th Street and Wings. Alright, so that does it for the brief reviews. Before any more goings on for me, any more rambling, why don't we get into the main event? The main event segment for today's episode of Radio Live Transmission. We're going to be talking about two albums today. One is the new self-titled album from the supergroup, if you want to call it that, Dead Cross. And then we are also going to be talking about the Faith No More album, King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime. So very happy to have a special guest on the episode today. He goes by the name of Jerry Cortez, or Mr. Venom, if you will. why don't you say hi, Jerry, before I go babbling on.
Hey, hello, listeners. Thank you for joining us tonight. And Ryan, thank you so much for inviting me on. This is actually my first foray into music podcasting, so this will be a new experience for me, but I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Nice. That's awesome. I'm glad to sort of be the for this to be the sort of maiden voyage, if you will, for you. All right. Well, Jerry, why don't you give the listeners some insight as far as, you know, your musical tastes and, you know, just I'm sure, you know, they probably changed a little bit over time. But I know that you and I definitely share a love for metal. That's for sure. So.
Oh, absolutely. Well, born and raised in Waterbury, Connecticut. So, you know, I was very familiar with a lot of like East Coast stuff, like, you know, early 80s Anthrax and stuff like that. Obviously a metalhead, as you already mentioned, pretty much been a metalhead since the day I had my own money to buy my own cassettes or albums. Right. One of the very first albums I ever bought with my own money was that first Quiet Riot album back in, I want to say 81 or 82. Mm-hmm. And yeah, ended up just playing the hell out of it, wore it out, ended up having to buy another one. the day that I bought the second copy of Mental Health, excuse me, or was it Metal Health? No, it's Metal Health.
Yeah, it's Metal Health.
And so on that day, I decided to go ahead and also buy Twisted Sister's Stay Hungry. And at that point, that was it. I was a metalhead for life. There was nothing that could be done. And metal pretty much my entire life. But then throughout my life, I've also had different stages where I was maybe listening to some jazz fusion or some Delta blues or even a little bit of hip hop there in the late 80s with the emergence of gangster rap. The rap in the 80s didn't really do a whole lot for me. You know, on the East Coast, we had a lot of Boogie Down Productions with KRS-One and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the stuff coming out of New York City, Afrika Bambaataa. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stuff, you know, it felt kind of bubblegum to me. It didn't really do a whole lot for me. But yeah, that first time I started hearing like stuff like NWA, that first NWA album, I kind of went out and seeked out some gangster rap. unfortunately, that stage didn't last too terribly long because right after that, I started playing live music. I started, you know, I had been playing bass since probably, I want to say, 84, 85 when I was around 15 years old. I've been playing bass my whole life. For the most part, metal, obviously. I've been in a few metal bands here and there, a couple in Connecticut where I was, you know, where obviously, like I said, I was raised. Mm-hmm. I went to college in Pittsburgh in 1994, joined a couple of bands out there that were actually my first foray into death metal, which was weird because I was never really a death metal fan, but as a bass player, I found that death metal was actually a fun genre to play live. Huh. I don't know how that happened, but yeah, like the closest thing to death metal, and technically I guess they are one of the pioneers of death metal, but Death.
Right.
You know, Chuck's band Death was a favorite of mine in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was the kind of thing where I could listen to a couple of songs here and there. I could never listen to an album straight, like the entire album, because it would just start to, you know, the vocals and the blast beats would just, you know, they would kind of start to grate on me. So stuff like Morbid Angel and Death, you know, I enjoyed individual tracks here and there. But then when I started playing it in a band called Fatality in Pittsburgh, I realized that this is a fun genre to play live, especially when you've got a good crowd, a good, vocal and, energetic crowd. It just makes your job on stage so much easier.
Yeah.
And I can definitely vouch for how hard it is to play in an empty club because I've done more of those than I have full clubs in my days. So anyway, back to me. Moved to Pittsburgh in 1994 to go to college, and at that point I started discovering some more local metal out in Pittsburgh. There were bands like Blind Justice and Crayon Death. Crayon Death is a band that I'm so upset didn't get more popular because they had spectacular vocalists. I forget his name, but he had a very deep voice, kind of like the guy from, what's the name of that New York band? Kind of hardcore metal, not Biohazard, Life of Agony.
Life of Agony.
The singer from Crayon Death actually had a very similar voice to the guy from Life of Agony, who I understand is now a woman. It's not a guy, but that's a whole other story. yeah, he got a sex change like in the late 90s, I believe. Mm. And actually, Life of Agony actually still performs with her singing. So, yeah, it was pretty interesting. I actually got to see a clip of her in a dress. And it, like I said, it was just really weird because, I mean, anybody who's familiar with Life of Agony remembers that singer. I mean, he was like a Harley Flanagan-looking, you know, hardcore-type guy. And then, you know, 10, 15 years later to see him in a dress, it was kind of it was an adjustment, but he still has the exact same voice, so it works. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that was, the Pittsburgh years, still very metal. That's when I started also getting into a little bit more alternative. I started dating my wife, the woman who is my wife now. That was 21 years ago. And, she kind of turned me on into more alternative stuff, like, I don't know, like Gravity Kills and Seven Mary Three and stuff like that. So, you know, that turned me on to that. I also would turn her on to some metal. I kind of got her into stuff like Slipknot and, you know, early Metallica, stuff like that. So, yeah, it worked out really nice. And then in 2000, ended up moving out to California. And once I got to California, man, it was almost all metal. I mean, there was just so much. The metal scene out here, it's not quite what it was in the 80s, but it's still amazing. Still lots of great bands, great local bands to see live. And my life, unfortunately, I don't have the diversity that I wish I had. My life is basically 90% metal with little speckles of other types of music here and there. kind of sprinkled in, but yeah, lifelong metalhead, and I'm pretty sure I'll die with the devil horns on my hand.
Awesome, man. That's good. Metal's one of those genres that I just sort of I never go too far like from metal. I mean, you know, I'll have phases, you know, where I'm like really into certain hip hop artists that I like, or I'm really into certain like you were saying, jazz fusion artists, really into you know, some like 90s alternative, really into some like 80s alternative stuff, like, you know, like new wave and mm-hmm. post-punk and all that. Post-punk is a pretty constant for me. But yeah, metal's one of those genres that I always come back to. Like, it's never far off of my radar. So always mm-hmm. just been a fan of the energy and the emotional weight of it. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So not that it's without its, you know, humor too. So we don't want to make it sound like everything's so serious.
Oh yeah. I found it, you know, growing up, I just found it to be one of the more passionate genres, you know, you come home from school, you had a bad day, pop on a little Judas Priest, and within three songs, you got a smile on your face. And
exactly,
that's pretty much, you know, metal was it was kind of my drug, if you will, growing mm-hmm. up. You know, I had a bad day. I didn't feel like dealing with parents or family or school or whatever. And yeah, I just pop in whatever Metallica or, you know, Guar that I might have floating around. And yeah, it was my passion. And when I say that it's one of the more passionate genres out there, I'm not necessarily talking about its aggression or its quote unquote heaviness. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, sometimes even the slower songs can elicit an emotional response from me. And, you know, that's mm-hmm. genuinely what I enjoy most about it. You know, the aggression is cool, but, you know, that's more something like, you know, when you're 15, 16 years old and you want to vent some steam, you know. Mm-hmm. Now it's more about the artistry. It's more about the musicianship, song arrangement, things like that really impress me. Mm-hmm. I mean, to this day, I still listen to a lot of the same metal bands I did back in the 80s, stuff like mm-hmm. Slayer. And but I'm also very heavy into some of the newer stuff, especially European stuff.
Yeah,
you know, stuff like Meshuggah, Soilwork. Mm-hmm. In the last year, I've gotten into Nightwish, that kind of mm-hmm. symphonic metal. I never got into symphonic metal before, but the first time I heard Nightwish perform, I believe Ghost Love Story was the name of the song, I was just mm-hmm. completely blown away by mm-hmm. this woman who could pull off metal vocals and operatic vocals at the same time. Not at the same time, but you know what I mean.
Right, right.
In the same song. And
right, right.
I was so impressed. I ran out and bought an album, and now I own every Nightwish, and I look forward to their new releases when they come out. And slowly that's led to my love of other symphonic metal bands, you know, like Within Temptation and stuff like that. So Epica is another one that I really dig. So you know, I'm like I said, I'm not as diverse as I wish I could be, but you know, I'm an old man. I'm set in my ways. So.
Well, it's hard. I mean, you know, I wish there were more hours in the day, you know, because just trying to make sure that I listen to as much music as is possible for me to listen to in, like, the amount of free time that I have, like,
exactly.
it's tough, but
it really is, and a lot of my free time is taken up listening to podcasts, and,
right.
you know, before we started recording, we were talking about the lengths of some of these podcasts. It's like, I only mm-hmm. have an hour drive to work, so it's like, if I want to listen to a four-hour podcast, it takes me 2 days,
right.
which, you know, and that takes away from my music listening, because for the most part, I really only listen to music in the car. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I'm, you know, for those who don't know, I'm a huge movie buff. I tend to watch more movies and play video games when I'm actually at home in front of a television. I don't really listen to as much music and podcasts when I'm home.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you're right. There's just not enough hours in the day. And I mean, I was having a conversation recently with a friend of mine who, you know, I was talking about all the different like types of podcasts that I have in my head that I would love to do. And it's like, there's just, you know, I can't be on eight different podcasts and still
right.
have a life. I mean, I'm married. Luckily I don't have any kids, so I do have some free time, but
yeah.
you know, I still got to show the wife a good time every now and then, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I can't see it. Yeah, you don't want to be spending your whole life sitting in front of a mic. She probably wouldn't be too happy about that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but all right, cool. Well, why don't we go ahead and we'll start talking about the Dead Cross album then. So.
Awesome.
All right. So the self-titled album from the band Dead Cross was released on August 4th on Ipecac Records, which is Mike Patton's label, and then also 31G Records. It was produced by Ross Robinson, who is, I mean, it's Ross Robinson. It's one of those guys. I mean, you can, the list goes on and on. I mean, he's worked with, you know, At the Drive-In. He's worked with Glassjaw. He's worked with Machine Head. He's worked with, he's worked with The Cure. I mean, he's kind of like one of those guys that's just everywhere. Right now, the lineup for Dead Cross is obviously Mike Patton doing the vocals, Dave Lombardo on drums, who is from, you know, Slayer and Suicidal Tendencies, a guy named Justin Pearson on bass, who was in the band The Locust, and he was also in a band called Head Wound City, and then on guitars is a guy named Mike Crane, who is formerly of the band Retox. So, and a little interesting sort of tidbit, Dead Cross originally formed in late 2015, and they had a different singer. I don't know if you knew about this, Jerry.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah, this guy, Gabe Serbian, I guess his name is?
Serbian, yeah.
Gabe Serbian, yep, who was also of The Locust, Head Wound City, and Retox. So, on vocals, and I guess, you know, they even, I'm not sure the extent of the vocals that he actually recorded for the band, but, I just know from doing some research that he definitely did record some vocal tracks for the group, and then, you know, they had a, he left the group in 2016, I guess they, you know, had a falling out or whatever, and then Patton came in and actually wrote, you know, new lyrics for the album, so it's pretty interesting, like, I wish I had looked before we did the podcast, I just didn't think of it, but I'd really like to look and see if I could find a couple of those tracks that they recorded with Gabe Serbian. So I'm interested to see, you know, especially if they're pretty much the same songs musically. I'd like to see, you know, how different his approach was from Patton, because we all know that Patton's approach is a pretty unique one usually, so.
Yeah, so. Unique is a good way to put it.
yeah. So, so that's, I thought that was pretty interesting. And then, the only other thing I really wanted to mention, was I usually throw out a Metacritic score for an album when I can find a Metacritic score, which is, you know, it's basically like an average, an aggregate, where they take a certain amount of reviews and, you know, spit out an average, you know. So I throw it out there for people who like to use those kind of reviews, you know, numbered scores. And so the Dead Cross self-titled album received a 75 out of 100, which on the Metacritic scale is considered generally favorable, and that's out of 15 reviews. So, and it seems like of the reviews I've read, you know, most critics seem to fall into that category. It's not up in the high, you know. It's not an 8 out of 10 or a 9 out of 10. It's somewhere around like a 7 or a 7.5. So, and I also just wanted to mention that my friend, and I'm not sure, you might be friends with him too, like on Facebook, but. This guy, 80 Stone, he's from England.
Mm-hmm.
I think he put it best when he said that the Dead Cross album is quote unquote fucking mental.
Yeah. So I actually have that in my notes that it's one of the more schizophrenic hardcore / metal albums I've heard.
I was like, you know, I read like 6 or 7 reviews of this thing, you know, which were like 3 or 4 paragraphs each. I was like, and 80 just like, he just summed it up in 2 words. That was all it needed to really be said. So, but so why don't we go through? We can talk about highlights for the album. Jerry, what would you say is your first highlight? I'm kind of figuring that you're probably going to start at the beginning, like I did.
Oh yeah, that first track. Definitely. I mean, it's just so. It definitely. I mean, even though I knew, you know, the lineup going into it, I purposely didn't read anything about the band when you had first brought up, you know, recording this episode. I kind of wanted to listen to the album fresh, and then when you posted the full album on Facebook, I mean, that first track just completely blew me away. Absolutely, you know, I just was not expecting something like that. Especially, you know, with Dave Lombardo kind of softening up over the years, but this was definitely like a return to form for him. I mean, this is the closest to early Slayer that I've heard him perform in a long time.
Yeah.
So yeah, that first track is just amazing. I don't have the track list in front of me, so I actually forgot the name
of
the title.
It's called Seizure and Desist.
There it is. Yep. But yeah, and I mean, that's probably the first highlight for me. And then, you know, three or four songs in, you've got my favorite Bauhaus song.
Yes.
And I had no idea that they were covering that. I just, yeah. I could not believe it. And when I just, when I heard the first chords of Bela Lugosi's Dead, I almost crapped myself.
Right.
I was in just absolute awe. Yeah. So yeah, that was a great homage to Peter Murphy and the rest of Bauhaus. So yeah, that was great.
Yeah. Yeah, I really, you know, if you go from Seizure and Desist, you know, sort of straight through up until Bela Lugosi's Dead, you know, the cover of Bela Lugosi's Dead, it's pretty much just a whirlwind. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Seizure and Desist sort of definitely establishes, you know, this sort of like odd blend of like hardcore fury and then with Patton's theatrics, you know, going on over it, it establishes it pretty efficient, well, not efficiently, pretty powerfully, I'd say. Patton's, you know, he's typically spastic, you know, on it. and it really, yeah, like I said, like we described it as a whirlwind. I mean, it's kind of old. That first track is kind of over before you even realize it, with some interesting sort of ambiance going on at the end there. And then I actually really like Idiopathic, too, the second track. It's amazing how quickly you can get used to the weirdness.
Yeah.
Like, since track two, I mean, like, the first track is, you know, like a couple minutes and change, and then track two starts, and I'm like, oh, okay, like, this is cool, I'm on board now, you know. so I'm already accustomed to the weirdness. And what always amazes me about Patton is just how he always manages to pull more, like, vocal tricks out of the bag. Like, he never seems to run out of, like, of just odd ways to vocalize to really sort of catch your ear and make you go like, wow, like there's not too many singers that do stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
You know? So I really like two in the middle of Idiopathic when it sort of stops chugging along at such a furious pace and it opens up a little bit. I like that it has a little bit of a like a swagger to it.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty cool because that's something that shows up a few times in the album. I think it's kind of cool because it balances well against the, like I said, the fury and the just the total like spastic, you know, craziness of so much of the album. So
yeah, I felt the same way about Obedient School too. You know,
yeah.
Kind of how you know you get a nice slow pace, but you know you've got a nice tight groove in there. I genuinely enjoy that song.
Yeah, I do too. And then it's interesting, like Obedient School and then Shillelagh. I like both tracks. I think they're both good tracks. And there's like enough different about those two tracks that I don't feel like one's a carbon copy of the other, but like it's funny, they were like very similar to me, which is kind of saying a lot because, you know, on an album with a lot of typically, you know, hardcore-esque rhythms and all that kind of stuff, I mean, you kind of expect some, you know, some similar rhythm patterns and stuff like that, but it's just funny, like even like the vocal patterns and the verses and stuff are like very similar in those two songs. That's just one thing that I noticed. I was kind of like, huh, that's odd. Like in Shillelagh, I really like Patton sort of penchant for using like, you know, chants. They're sort of like haunting.
Mm-hmm.
Comes in, and it's like it definitely like works in a very like strange way, strangely appropriate way over this music. I mean, you're always used to it with Faith No More, you know, and some of his other projects and stuff, but. It just, I don't know, it's funny. Like, it made me think of, like, the guy from Fear Factory. Burton Bell.
Oh, yeah. Burton C. Bell, yep.
Burton C. Bell, yep. Like, the, you know, kind of like the chants that he would do that were kind of very, you know, very haunting, you know. And so I like that. Shillelagh has a couple of, like, questionable, like, lyrical choices. I'm like, all right, it's Patton, but, I mean, he's, like, 50 years old now. Like, and he's like, you know, I took a pee and it came out red. I took a dump and it came out dead or something. I was just like, all right. I'm like, I'll give him, it's Patton, so I'll just sort of like give him the benefit of the doubt. But I'm like, I don't know. That seemed a little,
He could be, potentially he could be recalling, you know, past experiences. Hopefully, anyway.
yeah, right. So, all right. And then, yeah, and I'll tell you, when it gets to Bela Lugosi's Dead, that cover, that really, like you said, I was very excited when I heard it because I, you know, I was catching on as to what, you know, it was after the first like 10 seconds or so, and it's cool because it kind of establishes, because you've had this straight run through the first four songs where it's kind of breakneck, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And then you get to the cover of Bela Lugosi's End, you realize that this is going to be a Patton, like, project as far as, you know, being a little bit more musically expansive and a little bit more, you know, eclectic in its sort of, you know, influences, if you will.
Yeah.
So I really, yeah.
I genuinely enjoy, like, the placement of that song on the album. It, you know, being, like, the fourth or fifth track there, it gives you a nice, almost break from the just full-blown assault that you get from the first few tracks. You know, it slows down the pace, and, you know, it kind of gives you a break before the barrage of the next sonic assault that you're hit with for the next few tracks. So, yeah. I don't often talk about, you know, the song order on an album, but I genuinely love the fact that they placed it where it is. You know, and like I said, it's a great call to the past for those, you know, Bauhaus fans that are out there. You know, it's a great cover. It, you know, they don't add a whole lot to it to make it their own, other than, you know, Mike Patton's, you know, schizophrenic vocals. But it's enough. It's close enough to be a really nice homage, but still be very obvious that it's Mike Patton singing. So, right. Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's a short but sweet. It's like they, you know, they made sure that they didn't, like, if it had been much longer than it is, you know, then I think it kind of would have perhaps crossed that line into, I don't want to say bad imitation, but you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
They definitely could have dragged it on a little bit too long, you know?
Sure, sure.
So.
And that's the thing sometimes when I hear a Mike Patton project do a cover, you know, I'm always hopeful that they don't delve into parody at all, that they're actually giving the song the respect that it's due, and I feel like on this one they absolutely did that.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, like you said, it's sort of after this little break, interlude, if you will, then you sort of dive right back into the action with the track Divine Filth, which this track, like, even though it has a lot of parts that are very quick and very, you know, have that chugging, furious pace, like, it also has a little bit more of, like, a straightforward rhythm at times than some of the other songs, too, and even the vocals are a little bit, I feel like they're a little bit more melodic and less insane on this track, you know, for the most part. I mean, it has little touches of that, too, but it sort of signals for me when I listen to the album now, and even to an extent the first time I listened to it, that they are, like, you had Bela Lugosi's Dead and now this, so it's kind of like the back half becomes a little bit more of a melodic, not necessarily so spastic Patton project, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, not to, you know, and then of course, I mean, it goes into, did you have anything you wanted to say about Divine Filth? I don't want to cut you off.
No, not at all. Go ahead.
Okay, because I was just gonna say then it goes immediately into Grave Slave, where I mean, right off the bat, Patton's just like he's stretching his, like, it sounds like he's gonna blow his vocal cords out
a little bit
within like the first 10 seconds of the song. So he's not limiting himself at all, like, vocally. And then when it goes into the next track, which is called The Future Has Been Cancelled, to be honest, I really kind of feel like this one's a dud.
It's an odd one, definitely.
Yeah,
it almost doesn't fit.
Yeah, exactly. And like it doesn't really add anything like new to the, you know, to the mix. It's like the past few songs they've kind of been surprising you with like what they're doing and where they're going on the record, and then this one's just kind of like, okay, it's a little bit more of the same, you know, like the first four tracks on the album, but it also doesn't have, to me, it doesn't have like the intensity, like, and the sort of emotional, like, I don't know, like, honesty that, like, it is on the first four tracks. It's just kind of like, it's very flat to me.
A little bit, yeah.
And then the album moves into the track Gag Reflex, which, I mean,
yeah, this one I like.
Yeah, I do too. At 4.5 minutes long, I mean, this thing feels like, on this album, I mean, it feels like it's like a, you know, we're listening to any number of, you know, 10-minute plus songs, you know, in the metal genre or something. It just seems very long. It's kind of funny, but
oh, absolutely, it's definitely the magnum opus of this album.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a good way to put it. It appropriately, I think, like, you know, pulls the action down a little bit because, you know, we're getting to the you know, we're getting to the end of the album. So it's kind of like setting up the climax, if you will, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's this little interesting bit where Patton's like singing in Spanish.
That's right.
Yeah. He always like throws that in there. And then I don't know about this weird bit at the end where it seems like he's whispering Tampax over and over. Like, I was like, it was like the first time on the record where I had to like turn my headphones all the way up the first time I was listening to it to be like, is he really saying Tampax? And then I'm like, of course he's saying Tampax. It's Patton.
Like, if you think he's saying something ridiculous, he probably is.
Exactly. So yeah. So I thought that was interesting. So it was kind of like a WTF moment, you know. Yeah. So and then the album moves into the closer, which is Church of the Motherfuckers. So
Yeah, great title for Mom.
I was gonna say definitely. Yeah, wins a most interesting title on this record. Now, what's your take on this one? Because I kind of want to hear yours first before I say anything.
I mean, I kind of dig it. You know, it's another short form little, you know, explosion in your head, if you will. You know, it's got that whole landmine effect, if you will. You know, you step on it, boom, it hits you. And yeah. That's kind of how I feel about the song. I wouldn't call it a highlight of the album. It is one of the better songs. Ultimately, the album is short. I mean, there's only like eight or nine tracks. It's under a half hour long. So I mean, you know, you're looking at short, quick bursts of energy from the band. And yeah, I mean, this album, or excuse me, the track. I feel like it's a good representation of the aggressiveness of the album. You know, like I said, it's not one of my favorite tracks on the album, but it definitely is probably in the top half.
Okay. It's funny because when I listened to this track, the more I listened to the album and I would get to this track, I actually felt like this track could have, since this is a Patton project and inevitably, you know, it was going to sort of go off in a few different directions and not stick to just one, you know, not just going to stick to hardcore, you know. I actually felt like they could have put this track at the beginning of the album more as like a, more as like a, you know, an intro, like almost like I was imagining sort of like if you saw them live. Did you actually go to see them?
I ended up having to miss it, unfortunately. Okay. Yeah, I work part time for the NFL, and unfortunately there was preseason football that night, so I ended up having to work. Oh, I was so upset.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah,
but yeah, I almost feel like I was imagining like them playing a live show, and like of course, you know, they probably would want to start off with something fierce, you know, to sort of get the aggression going. But then I was almost like, well, this track is almost like, it sounds like one of those, you know, sort of a little bit slower tracks that a band will use to sort of, you know, open their set and like get everybody kind of pumped up a little bit before really throwing that first jab out there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to think, you know, you were talking about the sequencing of the tracks. I was starting to think about that a little bit more the more I listened to the album. I kind of feel like they could have thrown that song, like, at the beginning. Because it definitely, like we said, up until Bela Lugosi's Dead, it's just straight, you know, straight fury. And then you sort of, the back half of the record, sort of that's when you begin to realize, okay, yeah, this... like this is a Patton project, so so I thought, you know, I had a little bit of it's not necessarily like a negative for me, the sequencing, especially with an album that's half an hour long. I mean, it's over before you know it, so I don't really it's more of a nitpick. But why don't we go ahead and if you'd like to give it a rating, I always invite my guests to give it a rating, and
I'm gonna say I think I'm right there with the Metascore at 75. The first time I heard it, I probably would have given it a little bit higher score. I hate to say this, but I've kind of softened on how much I like the album with more re-listens. Right. I still love the album. Still think it's a great project. I definitely wish I could have seen them live because I'm very curious to see what kind of atmosphere that is. I think, like I said, with the more I listen to it, you know, the less energetic I am about it. I still love it. So, yeah, if I have to give it a score, I'm going to go ahead and go with that Metacritic of 75 or 7.5 out of 10, whatever you want to go with.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I'd say I've had a similar experience with it, where once the initial sort of novelty, if you will, I guess, of it, or just the, you know, just the excitement, you know, that sort of comes through on the first couple listens, once that wore off and I really started to kind of pick it apart a little bit more, dissect it, I could feel my rating like slipping a little bit too, from what it would have been, you know, the first day I listened to it. I would have been like, oh yeah, 7.5 out of 10 or 8 out of 10, you know. But yeah, I actually, I ended up giving it a 6.5 out of 10, just because I do feel that there are a couple of issues with sequencing with the tracks. Like, I feel like it could have been sequenced a little better. And then I do feel like a couple of the, I'd say that definitely the future has been canceled. Is like I said, it's kind of a dud. I mean, it could have been left off.
Sure.
You know, it, even like in those first four tracks, I mean, they're all good tracks, but they're not necessarily different enough from each other that I feel like they all are like, oh, definitely need to be there. So, especially on an album it's only 28 minutes or whatever, like we said, you kind of have to, like, you know, every song has to kind of be, you know, a really good, you know, gut punch or whatever. So,
yeah.
So I ended up, go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, I think the album speaks to me a little bit more, being from the East Coast and listening to a lot, especially in the early 90s, listening to a lot of like the hardcore / metal / punk stuff that was coming out of New York, like Biohazard, Madball, stuff like that. I think this kind of harkens back to those days for me. I mean, I haven't heard anything that sounds like this probably, you know, potentially since the Cro-Mags. And I kind of miss it. It's one of those things where I didn't realize I missed it because, you know, I enjoy everything I listen to. But then when I listened to this, especially those first few tracks, I was like, wow, I feel like it's 1993. I loved it.
Yeah.
But like I said, I'm right there with you. I kind of, you know, it slipped a little bit, but obviously based on our scores, you know, it speaks a little bit more to me. And, I'm genuinely looking forward to what these guys are doing next. And if they do come around to LA again, I will make a point to go see it.
Yeah. I would definitely like to get out there too, if they come somewhere around here, even if it's New York. So,
yeah.
All right, cool. Well, I was just going to say that I've definitely, like, I hope that, you know, if they're going to do another project, they're going to do another album, that it's sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am very interested in where they would go from here. I mean, it's like it's an interesting album to begin with, and it's like, holy crap, where can you go from here? So.
Yeah, definitely with all of those guys having, you know, other projects too. I mean, you know, we could be sitting here waiting, you know, 6, 8, 10 years for the second album.
Right.
Hopefully it's not that long. You know, I'm right there with you. I'd rather not wait that long, but, you know, especially Lombardo, man. I think I've seen Lombardo in like 4 different bands over the years. That guy is busy. Obviously Patton too.
All right, so that's one album down. That was our current album that we're going to look at today, and now we will let's move into talking about the album King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime, which is by the band Faith No More. Obviously, Patton's most famous, you know, or I should say that's his most well-known band, definitely. As I think he put it in an interview I read, that was his day job. It was released March 28th, 1995. That's hard to believe. On Slash Records, apparently. And it was produced by Andy Wallace, who, much like Ross Robinson, is another guy with a list a mile long of bands that he's worked with. I mean, Slayer, Nirvana, Rush, Sonic Youth, Bruce Springsteen, The Cult, Prince. He's all over the place. So,
oh yeah,
definitely a veteran. And a lot of times with older albums, you know, you don't find a Metacritic score necessarily. So what I did for this one was I just, you know, just looked up a couple of ratings from different publications. So AllMusic gave King for a Day 3.5 out of 5. Entertainment Weekly, I always kind of do this because it's just funny to me. Entertainment Weekly, like, I don't really give any credence, but they gave the album a C-. Ooh, and
ouch.
Yeah, I know. Rolling Stone gave it a 2 out of 5.
Ooh. Aww.
I know, right? I know. I was kind of upset too. And then Spin gave it a 6 out of 10, so, I mean, they were...
That's a little better.
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of, like, heartened at the end there. Oh, okay, Spin. So why don't we, for this time, I kind of didn't do this with the last album, but that's okay because we just started talking right, going right into the tracks. But why don't you, for this album, Jerry, give the listeners, you know, and me, give us like your overall, you know, feeling about this album, especially since, you know, it's an album that has been around for so long, so I'm sure you've listened to it a million times.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. First and foremost, this is my favorite Faith No More album. Angel Dust would be a very close second, but this one, it's something about the production on this album, something about the musicianship, just it just absolutely blew me away. And to this day, and as you said, I've never stopped listening to it. I mean, this is an album that is, you know, almost a monthly listen for me since 1995. I remember buying this album the day it came out. My wife and I are, you know, we were both big Faith No More fans at the time. I had actually seen Faith No More on the Angel Dust tour for the first time. They played up at UConn up at Gamble Pavilion. And that was a great show. Helmet opened up that one, which that was a great double bill. Yeah. So, like I said, favorite album, absolutely. I mean, the album, unfortunately, the album immediately flew under the radar, which, you know, is unfortunate, you know. Pretty much all their albums after Angel Dust and which corresponds with the departure of Jim Martin, of course, which honestly, I mean, you know, if I have to be honest, Jim Martin is probably the most recognizable of the band members, you know. I mean, the rest of the guys, you know, maybe Mike Borden on drums, you know, with his dreadlocks and, you know, cool goatee. But, I feel like when Jim Martin left, I think the band lost a little bit of its personality, maybe not musically, but visually. And I think unfortunately that led to, you know, the lowering of their popularity with every album after Angel Dust. And that's unfortunate because I feel like this is an incredibly underappreciated album. You know, one of my favorite rhythm sections ever, Mike Borden and Billy Gould. And I think this is like the pinnacle of their work. I mean, I may not say that, you know, the best, quote unquote, best Faith No More songs appear on this album, but from beginning to end, to me, this is their masterpiece. This is the one where, you know, their production was on point. The song arrangement, the individual musicians, just I feel like, you know, this was their master of puppets, if you will. This is where they came together and presented me with the best version of Faith No More that I had ever heard. You know, obviously we'll get into this track by track, but yeah, I mean, some of the highlights like Ricochet, the title track, and my favorite song on the album, which we'll probably discuss fairly lengthy, is, The Gentle Art of Making Enemies. I could listen to that song. I literally could listen to that daily. It's such an amazing song. And it still puts a smile on my face. Like, it still makes me laugh. It's still funny to me. You know, 22 years later, and some of the lines on there still make me laugh. I'm thinking about it right now, and I'm laughing. I mean, I love that song so much. But yeah, overall, you know, I can't say enough great things about this album. Sonically, you know, one of the more perfect things that they put out, again, in my opinion. Sadly, you know, as Ryan discussed with the scores that we just went over, the general public and the critics didn't love this album the way a lot of us did. I know a few Faith No More fans who would consider this their favorite album, and you know, I can't disagree with them. Absolutely love it. And to speak to about the guitar player, Trey Spruance, is that how you pronounce it?
I think so.
You know, he may not have had the personality both visually and musically that Jim Martin had, but I still think what he did, and he is from Mr. Bungle, so obviously he has a relationship with Mike Patton, so they've worked together before, and I feel like even though the guitar playing on this album may not be as stellar as some of the stuff before it, I think it does the job perfectly. And, you know, again, you know, every member of the band on this album does such a great job. Roddy Bottom with his melodic keyboard parts just adds so much atmosphere to some of the songs. And, I could probably talk this album up for a few hours because, like I said, it is my favorite. And, you know, but I definitely would love to hear a differing opinion because I know this one isn't your favorite. Not to say that you don't love it, but I would love to hear, you know, I think you prefer Angel Dust, right? You mentioned?
Angel Dust would, Angel Dust is definitely my favorite, and then I'd say that it's kind of tough because Angel Dust for me is like that's on the top. That's number one, and then it's like almost like the other ones kind of fight it out. Yeah, like, mm-hmm. I feel like there's times when I like this one, at a number two. Sometimes I feel like The Real Thing, is number two. It's kind of like the other ones, yeah, sort of. They're interchangeable to me.
Sure.
But I was actually very glad that you suggested this because I always like to talk about, if you have a certain band's catalog, I don't really like to talk about my favorite as much as I like to talk about something that's not necessarily my favorite, because I find that it's just more interesting, to,
mm-hmm.
Instead of just, I feel like sometimes I'm just going to pour praise all over something, and I don't want to do that. Like, I really like sort of talking about, albums that I have might have a different opinion of than someone else, because I feel like that's the meat of what I love about discussing music. Yeah, so definitely. So I'd say yeah, Angel Dust is definitely my favorite, but this one on certain days I'd say I'd say would be my number two. Yeah. So
no, actually, yeah, definitely my number two would probably change based on my mood as well. And I still love the first album with Charlie Murphy. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
It still does a lot for me. I'm an old Faith No More fan. I was a fan of them with Charlie Murphy. Believe it or not, the first time I heard Epic, I actually did not like it. It was such a departure from what they had done, before, that I was like, wow, this is still Faith No More. But then the first time I heard the track, what's the name of it? From Out of Nowhere, I think.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. First time I heard that, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm back on board. And to this day, Epic is not one of my favorite songs. I appreciate it. It's definitely the song, the track, and the video that put them on the map. So I appreciate what the song did for them, but it's by far not one of my favorites of theirs.
It's kind of one of those tracks that, to a certain extent, like exists almost outside of the context of. Of The Real Thing, because it's just like with the video being all over MTV and just, it just kind of reached that level where it was like, suddenly it was almost like it's not even the band song anymore. it's weird. So, but as far as King for a Day, overall, I like a lot of the material on this record. I do have like a couple of issues with it. I have an issue with the end of the record. but as far as the songs themselves, I definitely enjoy them. I mean, I don't really think there's any tracks on this record that I would call bad, that I would call a throwaway.
No, not at all.
But yeah, like I said, I just have a little bit of an issue with like the end of the album. So obviously we'll get to that. So,
mm-hmm.
The thing kicks off, with Get Out. I think it's a good opener. I think it, it gets the point across, and I think it's like a good enough sort of cross section of, the sound of this record.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who just like, picked the album up on a recommendation from a friend or something who had never heard Faith No More would sort of, would to a degree get, what's about to be presented to them if they listen to this track. So,
and I actually love that they just started out with just bass, drums, and vocals. It's almost like, I hate to say it, but it's almost like a middle finger to Jim Martin. Like, yeah, okay, we don't need you. listen to how great we sound, without a guitar player even playing. I agree. That first track, Get Out, it's nice and short. It's just over 2 minutes. It does exactly what it's meant to do. It mm-hmm. conveys the tone of the album, sets up, a lot of what you're going to hear on the rest of the album. And yeah, it's probably one of my favorite Faith No More, album opening tracks.
Mm-hmm. And then when the album moves into Ricochet, the thing that surprised me the first time I listened to this album was after listening to the first two tracks, I was like, I'm kind of surprised that I was about to say patent the sort of typical patent quirkiness and weirdness, like it hasn't really come out yet, And I thought that was kind of surprising. At first I was kind of like, oh, like, you know, he's not, you know, he's kind of like holding back a little bit. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, you know, it's kind of cool that he did that, because it shows that, you know, he's not, you know, he doesn't want to fall into the sort of trap of being pigeonholed, you know, yeah. or being like a one-trick pony, you know, whatever. So I kind of like that, you know, they spent the first couple of tracks just sort of, you know, setting the tone more musically, I think. Mm. And, yeah, definitely. And then we get to Evidence.
Yes.
why don't you give me your take on Evidence first, though?
Oh, my God, Evidence. I mean, I love the track. I can't. It's definitely a departure from what you hear on the first two tracks on the album. Mm-hmm. This was another song that I hearkened to earlier with Roddy Bottom really providing some nice melodic keyboard parts. Same thing with Ricochet. And, it's not my favorite. It's not even remotely my favorite track on the album, but I feel it's a nice lead in to my favorite track, which is the next track on the album. So. I appreciate it for that.
One of the things that I really like about Faith No More is I like that they have the confidence to they'll spend a whole track sort of going down a particular musical avenue. You know, not like, you know, there's a lot of bands who, you know, will incorporate certain elements into their music. Like there's a band that's been around for, I don't know, 15, 20 years now. I don't know if you know who they are. They're called Dog Fashion Disco.
I've heard the title, but I don't think I've ever heard him.
Okay. Well, when you listen to Dog Fashion Disco, you can hear the Faith No More influence, the Mr. Bungle influence.
Okay.
Just the general Patton influence. And the thing about Dog Fashion Disco is they'll incorporate these elements, like things that you hear on Evidence, and even like the track Star AD that's coming up in a little while. They incorporate those elements into their music, but you know, it's all balanced against, you know, just like heavier stuff. So that's what I really appreciate about Faith No More, is that they'll let a song like this breathe. Like they'll stick to this one, like I said, this one musical avenue, this one departure that they want to go down, and they're not afraid, you know, to do that. I think it's really cool. I think the track shows a lot of restraint, you know.
Yeah.
And especially like that, I think I like a lot of the guitar work on this album too. Like I think it definitely shows like a facet, or, you know, a side of the band that, you know, was seen a little bit before, but I think, like you said, with the coming on board, you know, of Trey Spruance, you know, I think that it might have signaled, you know, a little bit, you know, that they might go down a slightly different path here and there. So
absolutely, and Evidence also kind of showed me that these guys can do funk in a way that if they were to do an entire album of funk stuff, I would buy it, because I mean, they show their chops, they show that they can, that they've got ability to do some funk stuff. I mean, I consider the song kind of a dark R&B ballad. But yeah, I just absolutely love the dichotomy of this track to the next one coming up. So yeah, love it.
I was reading online too. I thought this was kind of funny that, on one of the tours that they did after releasing this album, they were saying that Patton, like, whatever country they happened to be in, like, he would sing the vocals, like, for evidence in, like, the country's, like, you know, native language or our home language.
That's cool.
I'm like, it's funny. I'm just like, it just seems like, Patton's really, you know, he's really going the extra mile here. Like, that sounds very, like, complicated to me.
Yeah. as soon as we're done here, I'm actually going to jump on YouTube, see if I can find any of those performances. Yeah. I'd love to hear Evidence in Spanish.
Yeah, it's just like, it just cracks me up. I'm like, it's just so typical for him. But, all right, so, so now we move into, like you said, your favorite track on the album, and I think it's safe to say that it's mine, too.
Nice.
Yeah, The Gentle Art of Making Enemies. You give me your take first.
Well, I mean, first off, Patton's voice in this track. Mm-hmm. I mean, he gives you the full range. You know,
right.
It starts out with kind of the the more, you know, the deeper tones that he likes to spit out every now and again. And then, mm-hmm. you know, it starts to get a little bit more frantic as it gets to the right. bridge. And mm-hmm. then, you know, into the main chorus where, you know, it almost turns into a straight metal track. And I definitely love his range on this album. And like I mentioned earlier, these lyrics are spectacular. I mean, you know, I'm the best fuck you've ever had. Come on. That is poetry right there.
I know. It's like any, you know, like Patton, he may have been holding back, you know, in the first three tracks here, but it's like it all just comes out. It's like he unkinked the hose, basically. Like here it all comes all at once. But I agree wholeheartedly about the lyrics. Just like the little things where he's like, "Happy birthday, fucker," you know, like stuff like that. Like it's so him, and it's so it's one of the things that is at the top of the list for you know, what made Faith No More so appealing mm-hmm. to me. You know, it was like one of the first times where I saw and heard, you know, a quote unquote metal band. I mean, even though that's, you know, kind of pigeonholing, but mm-hmm. You know, somebody who could have fun and not really like take themselves too seriously. You know, because that was, you know, how metal was in the 80s, you know, there was a lot of that not being able to laugh at yourself thing going on, you know.
Absolutely.
Tough guy attitude, which thankfully has seemed to a large extent sort of gone the way of, you know, gone bye-bye or whatever. But, mm-hmm. yeah, and, you know, what really, like, makes me mad is the other day I was just perusing either iTunes or Amazon Music or whatever, and I had never really looked at, like, it's, like, one of the best of, you know, Faith No More collections. It's, like, mm-hmm. basically the one that's one CD, which I'm always like, how can you fit it all?
Yeah.
But I was looking at it, and I'm like, oh, man, like, The Gentle Art of Making Enemies is not on this.
That's upsetting.
That, like, irked me big time. I'm like, come on, you know, I mean, but.
Just for the poetic aspect alone, it should
exactly.
be on.
Exactly. I'm like, damn, like. Goddamn music industry, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I genuinely can't think of too many other Faith No More tracks that take advantage of Patton's vocal range like this one does.
Yeah.
You know, and I appreciate it. You know, you've got your heavy, mm-hmm. crunchy, melodic chorus, which, I mean, I actually love his vocals on that chorus. I mean, he legitimately sounds like almost like a Juilliard trained vocalist, you know.
Right,
genuinely loved it.
Mm. All right, well, So that was our favorite track. Now it's all downhill, right? So.
I might not go that far, but
No.
Man, the next track though. I mean, if Gentle Art of Making Enemies is where the album just starts to get a little frantic, then mm-hmm. Cuckoo for Caca is where Frantic slaps you in the face.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh.
Yeah.
Love
what
it.
About Star? What about Star AD though? Before you,
oh,
you
that's right.
Anything about Star AD?
Great little track. Definitely, mm-hmm. You know, one of the slower tracks again on the album, but you know, they pull it off masterfully, and
yeah.
I genuinely love it. Not really one of my highlights on the album, but ultimately, like you said earlier, I don't think there's a bad track on this album. You know, you can make an argument for Just a Man, which I'm sure we'll do here in a little bit, but you know, again, one of the slower tracks. I genuinely love some of the different instruments that they're using, like the scratch pad. I genuinely, I love that. You know, that's definitely not anything that I would have thought I would hear on a Faith No More album in 95.
Right.
Yeah.
right, yeah. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I definitely think, like Star AD is sort of a, evidence is, like, more exciting, like, sibling, almost in a way, mm-hmm. like, kind of, because it kind of brought, like, the funk a little bit again. But, you know, the song has a little bit more, like, dynamics, you know, than Evidence did. So, yeah, so like you said, it's not a bad track, nothing to write home about, you know, but yeah, like you said, going into the next track, Cuckoo for Caca, I mean, it's kind of like now Patton's fighting this, like, battle, like, we're going to go between, we're going to go between, like, what's more insane, I mean, I really like, sort of sinister sound that enters into the mix, like, with this track by way of, like, you know, the synths.
Yeah.
And just a lot of, like, the sound effects with the bells and everything. And
yeah, I actually have in my notes here that this is the creepiest that the organ sounds on the whole album.
Yeah.
It definitely adds to the feel, the tone of the song.
Yeah, but it's cool because it has that like eeriness, but then it also is totally just like, you know, spastic and nuts, you know, at certain times, especially with his vocals. I mean, he really gets like, you know, talking about the Dead Cross album, like he sort of gets, you know, pretty close to, you know, what he's doing on Dead Cross, you know, with this song vocally, uh-huh. With a lot of those screams and everything. Also has like some of the most like frenetic sort of sounding guitar riffs on the album, which I appreciated. And also too, like it's impossible for me not to think about albums, like album structure and sequencing now, like I think because I've been doing this podcast and it's like I've really been analyzing albums so much, which is like I feel like it's like a gift and a curse kind of, you know,
mm-hmm.
like you know, it's like when you watch a movie and you're like,
oh yeah, same, there, yeah.
There's the pinch and there's the, you know, like, you know, all, you know, which is, I mean, you know, it's good because a lot of times, you know, I'll do the work for this podcast and then when I'm done with a particular episode, then it's like, okay, let me go back and listen to the album now just to enjoy it again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a rewarding experience, you know, so.
Definitely.
But yeah, definitely cool. I feel like this one, because I mentioned the structuring and the sequencing and everything, I feel like Cuckoo for Caca is sort of like it's sort of like a midway point on the album.
I'll go with that.
I'd say, yeah, like a, we'll call it a, I don't know, we'll call it a mid-season finale. If we're going to go with like a Walking Dead reference here or something, you know, but, yeah, cause you go from that, which feels like I said, like a climax of its own, and then you go into, and I don't even really want to try to pronounce the name of the next track.
Oh, okay.
Maybe I'll leave that up to you, Jerry.
I got it. I gotcha. All right. It is pronounced Corallo Voador. Okay. And basically what that is it's the Portuguese word for flying fuck.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, it's funny. I was, I was listening to the album and I was looking at the lyrics on that new app that I think it's called Genius,
mm-hmm.
where they'll have the lyrics. So like if you don't have the lyrics handy, you know, you can just like look right there. And a lot of times they'll have little annotations for the lyrics, you know, and somebody had put how like basically this flying fuck is like it's a big like bathroom graffiti thing, I guess, in Brazil.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and people just they draw like a basically like a dick with wings.
Nice.
And yeah, so I guess that's where Patton picked it up. I'm not really sure, but yeah, I mean, it's an interesting song lyrically. It's mm-hmm. kind of like one of those like sort of double meaning things, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like this tale of, you know, this guy who's driving a little too fast and you know, is kind of afraid of one day just basically, I guess, you know, run somebody over.
Yeah.
And and I just think it's hilarious too that like the lyrics that Patton sings in I believe they're in Portuguese at one point.
Most of the song is in Portuguese, yes.
That's right, most of it is, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it like basically boils down to him saying something to the effect of I can't drive and my fingers shoved in my nose or something like that. Like it's just, I like too that it's kind of like this, if the last track was like a climax, this is kind of like the falling action, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this song kind of harkens back to the kind of the laid back feel of Evidence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the song as much as Evidence. I think Evidence is a stronger track, but mm-hmm. I mean, this one still kind of has that cool, smooth, kind of catchy, you know, catchiness of it, if you will. Carajo Voador is, it's definitely, how can I put this? I wouldn't call it one of my favorite tracks on the album again, mm-hmm. but I do enjoy it. I wish I would have taken the time to just translate the lyrics because I'm sure they're great.
Right.
I mean, the few that you've translated for me are just hysterical, but
yeah.
I'm sure the entire track is just awesome in English. But yeah, I'll probably do that later too, just to check it out. you know, educate myself a little bit. I don't speak Portuguese. I'm Spanish, for those who don't know. Last name Cortez from the East Coast. So yeah, Spanish and Puerto Rican. So yeah, you know, I speak Spanish, but my Portuguese is a little lacking, let's say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was a little like, I feel like I'm going to embarrass myself trying to pronounce this. So.
The best way to put it is the L is silent, so it's carajo, And then in English, VOA would be one syllable, but in Portuguese it's two. So it's voador. Right. So it's carajo, okay. Carajo, voador.
Okay. So I know what to, like, call somebody. I know how to pronounce it now if I want to call somebody that, like, when I'm on the road or something.
Yeah, next time you're in Brazil, you're all set.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Have to get down there just to take advantage of that.
There you go.
Yeah, so. All right, so now that we've crossed the midpoint, if you will, the album moves into the track "Ugly in the Morning," mm-hmm. which to me just sounds like a hangover.
A little bit.
Yeah, it really just does. Like, and I think like the you know when, once I really started listening to the lyrics and everything, like it just compounded that effect. You know, it's because it's got a lot of ups and downs, like. You know, like your stomach kind of like churning, you know, the day after drinking too much, or you know, a headache that's throbbing or coming and going, you know. But you know, it's got like jagged guitars. I just really like the pairing of the lyrics about you know this person that's kind of like the object of the song being you know prettier the night before, pairing that with this really chaotic. You know, some might call it less pleasant, you know, music than, you know, like some of the other tracks or whatever. But that's kind of like the overall take I get from that song. It kind of makes me chuckle a little bit, you know. Yeah.
Completely agree.
And then, like, when the album moves into Digging the Grave, this track reminds me of The Real Thing, like, in its approach. Because it's a little more, I feel like it's just, like, a little bit more straightforward and, it's like I'm kind of indifferent to it. Like I don't dislike it. I'm not gonna skip over it when it comes on, but it doesn't get the same response out of me as you know Gentle Art or even the you know Ugly in the Morning or one of the more dynamic tracks on the album. So
yeah,
so I kind of just I'm like okay, this one's not bad, you know, but. But what's your take on that one?
I mean, being that it was the first single off the album and video,
oh, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like it's definitely the most accessible song on the album as far as, you know, putting the single out, getting people to, because right, it's right. A very straightforward Faith No More track. I mean, honestly, I mean, it doesn't scream Faith No More by any stretch other than Mike Patton's vocals. But, you know, I feel like it's a solid track. Again, not one of my favorites. I might be a little bit more apt to skip it when I'm listening to it for enjoyment. Just because I've heard it so much. Because, like I said, being a huge Faith No More fan, they actually put that song, the track out, something like 2 or 3 weeks before the album was out. So, like, the video and the single were out. And MTV, of course, was bombarding us with it. Unfortunately, it didn't catch on the way something like Epic did. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's one of those tracks that it's probably the track that I got sick of the quickest on the album. Let's say that it's the least original. It's like I said, it's radio friendly, which you know isn't necessarily a bad thing. We all got to make money, you know.
That's true.
Yeah, so you know, I don't hate the track, but it's definitely not one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's funny now that you. Because I had forgotten that it was the lead, you know, like the lead off single, and yeah, that makes total sense because I just think about so many albums from the recent past, like trying to think of a good example, like Mastodon's latest album, Emperor of Sand, I couldn't think of the name there,
yeah,
and you know, they kind of you know they had like dropped a couple of tracks or maybe like one that was a little bit more your typical Mastodon by the numbers, I think, to sort of like, you know, make the fans happy. But then like the first real single and the song that they made like a video for was that track Show Yourself.
Yep.
And it was the same, it's kind of like very similar to this where I was just like, okay, I mean, this song seems just completely engineered to get radio airplay.
Yeah. I mean, these tracks like that and, Digging a Grave, it's like, you know, they're meant for accessibility. And the thing is, too, is that they're not the greatest representations of the album either. Like,
you hear
something like Show Yourself or Digging a Grave, and it's like, and then you buy the album and you're like, oh, wow, the rest of the album sounds nothing like this, which, mind you, I loved. I was very okay with that.
Oh, but yeah, definitely.
It's one of those things where I've always felt, you know, all my life, whether I was in a band or not, you know, the first track off an album should be a representation of the album as a whole.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
You know, you don't want to put out the most obscure track on the album, because then if people love that track, buy the album, realize the rest of the album sounds nothing like that track, they might be a little pissed off. But I was the complete opposite when I picked up the album, having only heard Digging a Grave and I think one other track, whatever the B-side was for that one. I was definitely anticipating something different, but what was presented to me, I was so happy with. I was so happy that it didn't follow the Digging the Grave, kind of formula, if you will.
I was just reminded of, I was never a huge, Evanescence fan. I kind of was like, okay, like, you know, a lot of people like this, so I'm not going to tell them to turn it off if it's on the radio, but I wasn't huge. But I did, like, for a little while, I really liked that first single, I think, Bring Me to Life, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the thing was, I was under the impression that there was both a female vocalist and a male vocalist in the band, and I thought it was, like, a cool interplay. And then I remember I think I went out and picked up the album, and I was just kind of, like, disappointed. I'm like, oh, all right, it's... like just Amy Lee for like the rest of this record or whatever. And she's got a great voice and everything.
Sure.
It's just, I was just kind of like, well, that's kind of a deceptive, you know, way to go about, you know, getting people to buy this album. And it was funny because shortly after that whole thing, I found out about that band Lacuna Coil.
Yes. I was just about to mention that.
So I was like, okay, I don't even need Evanescence anymore.
Lacuna Coil, the first time I heard them, I felt like that's what Evanescence was supposed to sound like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. That's so, what I always tell people, like, you think this band's good, just listen to Lacuna Coil.
Exactly. Like,
tell me if you still think Evanescence is great, you know? But
And yeah, I'd rather look at Christina Scabbia than Amy Lee any day.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I would definitely agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Amy Lee has a great voice, but I think, yeah, Christina, I think I prefer her voice a little bit more, especially in the realm of metal, or quote unquote metal, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like Christina Scabbia, like her voice, I think she's more interested in how her voice can like work for the music. Whereas like with Amy Lee, I feel like it's a little bit more like performance.
Yeah.
Based, you know, like she's a little bit more worried about her vocal, you know, but
sure,
you know, whatever. That's neither here nor there.
Yeah, it kind of harkens to the symphonic metal that I was talking about earlier.
That's true.
Those bands with female vocalists, they want to be up front, right there, up in your face. They want to be the most dynamic part of the music. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So from the sort of Digging the Grave. The album moves into the track Take This Bottle, which I really like this track, always have, and I feel like I'm liking it more and more as time goes on, too.
Yeah.
Because I feel like here's a spot where, you know, all the sort of drama and the theatrics of Patton's vocals, he sort of lets all that kind of like fall away, and like here's this very kind of like confessional, you know, earnest song.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of to the beginning of where my problem with this album starts. And the best way that I can put it, because I was having a hard time like trying to describe exactly what my problem was, it feels to me like I remember when, you're probably a Lord of the Rings fan, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Not that you're like, where is he going with this? But I remember when Return of the King came out, I was hearing from a lot of people that I knew who did not know the source material that they kept thinking that the film was going to end.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't ending. Like they were like, okay, like, all right, is this the end? Okay. Oh no, there's more. Like this happened like five times, you know,
yeah.
Which to me, it wasn't a problem. I knew exactly, you know, pretty much what was going to happen. But,
mm-hmm.
This is where I sort of feel like this album starts to go into that mode a little bit where it's kind of like a lot of tracks that feel like closing tracks.
Oh, it's true. I mean, I agree. Take This Bottle feels like a closing track. It's got that cool country western kind of twang to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely an experiment. Kind of like, what was the track on Angel Dust? RV, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
Was it... Is it Arnie?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
It kind of harkens back to that. I think I enjoy this track, Take This Bottle, a little bit more than I did RV. I still love RV and everything on Angel Dust. But, but I agree with you. This is kind of like, Take This Bottle kind of starts, if you will, in a movie term, the third act of this album. And it's a weird start to the third act, if you will. It's a little somber. It definitely brings down the mood of the album, the experience of listening to the album. And, so it's an odd track. It's definitely, it's one of those tracks that almost, it doesn't really feel like it belongs on this album, really. As great a track as it is, and I do enjoy it, and I never ever skip it. I love the track, but it definitely feels a little disjointed from the rest of the album.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, definitely. Mm. And then the album moves into King for a Day, which is another good song. You know, I could definitely accept like this song also as a closing song. Since this one, I feel like it has a little bit more musical ups and downs and a little bit more dynamics than Take This Bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like instead of like ending on a confessional note, like with Take This Bottle, it's like, you know, Faith No More could have ended with this track, which is a little bit more various, like in its approach lyrically and musically and everything. Mm-hmm. And you know, just the fact that it's 6.5 minutes, like
it is a big,
sure feels like a closer to me.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So it's like, it's got that. It's like built to be, you know, a closer for the record. So, but it's like, no, we're not at the end yet. It's like, so yeah. So then it's like, then the album moves into this track, What a Day, which I feel like this song, like it's almost like it wandered into like this party of like big closers or ballads that's going on. Like it just sort of stumbled in. And it's kind of like in the same way that I'm indifferent to Digging the Grave. Like I'm kind of indifferent to this one too.
I feel a little bit more for this song than Digging the Grave. Mm-hmm. I think it just might have been the repetition of the, you know, the fact that it was the first track, and you know, I was so excited. I listened to it almost on an endless loop until the album came out. So I was definitely, you know, by the time the album came out, I was a little sick of the song. I still listened to it and loved it. But I definitely feel like this track. I love What a Day. I think that chorus is great. It reminds me a little bit of the chorus from Gentle Art of Making Enemies, not quite as dynamic as that one, but, you know, kind of the same feel, if you will, and maybe not quite the same vocal range that Mike Patton shows off on Making Enemies, but I this is probably one of my favorite of the later tracks on this album, King for a Day and What a Day.
Yeah, I kind of wondered if, after wrapping my head around the album, I sort of wondered whether if they had stuck this track a little bit earlier on the record, and if there weren't quite as many big like closing style songs at the end, like I wondered if it might have come off a little differently, like in a slightly different, you know, continuity or context or whatever.
Yeah.
I
could definitely see that track being earlier on the album, maybe in between Evidence and Gentle Art of Making Enemies, something along those lines. It definitely feels out of place later in the album because it's, you know, it's kind of an upbeat song, which, like I said, it feels out of place sandwiched with, you know, Take This Bottle and Last to Know and things like that. So it's an odd placement. I still love the track, but I agree with you. It's a weird placement.
Right, and then with the track The Last to Know, I mean, it's hard for me to even like come up with anything I feel like I can say like specifically about this song, because I feel like it's so kind of, it has the same kind of vibe as King for a Day and Take This Bottle. Like it's close enough to those that nothing makes it really like stand out. Nothing makes me say like, oh, this should have been the final song. You know, like it's just kind of, it's a good song. I like it, but it's just kind of like I said, one more step at the end where we're like, okay, we're like, when's this thing gonna end? You know, like, and it's, I don't want people to get the impression that I'm like suffering through, you know, listening to the end of this album, like I'm like ready to pull my hair out, or like, you know, I'm gouging my eyes out or anything like that. It's nothing like that. It's just kind of, it's just kind of like more perplexing.
Yeah, to me. It's definitely like, an odd. Oh, you're talking about the end of the album as a whole?
Yeah, not necessarily this track okay. itself. I just mean the whole like thing at the end here, where all of a sudden it's like an ending and then another ending and then another, you know.
Okay.
So, which I mean, because here's the thing about what happens. Like my experience when I listen to this album is, especially the first couple times, when that happens, where I'm kind of going, okay, like they're doing this again. Now they're doing this again. It kind of takes me out, you know, of the experience of the album. Like we were talking about earlier, we were talking about movies, how you sort of give yourself up to a movie,
uh-huh.
And then you know it's I think it's a lot easier to enjoy it that way instead of sort of fighting against it. And that's kind of how the end of this album, you know, makes me feel more like I said on my initial listen, but you know, still now sometimes it's just kind of like I'm like. Puzzling over it, like it's just weird to me. Like, why did they do this? Like, but yeah, it's not a bad song by any means.
Yeah, I feel like this is especially the guitar solo in this song. I feel like it's
yes,
the high yeah. point for Trey. Definitely a mm-hmm. shining moment, if you will. I don't know. This is the track I wish they would have ended with. Just a Man, which, you know, we'll get to in a second, is a weird way to end the album, the original album anyway. Because I actually have the reissue, the 20th anniversary reissue, and there's like three extra mm-hmm. tracks on it.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
It's like, no, there's more.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, yeah. I do enjoy the track, you know, it's got some slow, heavy riffs in there, mm-hmm. you know, decent lyric line, you know, over the nice melodic track. Like I said, probably my, you know, as a musician, I feel like this is Trey's high point on the album, you know, and it's pretty sad that it's so late in the album, because by this point, I think
yeah.
people have already kind of given up on the fact that, you know, Faith No More is going to have a stellar guitar player, you know, in the forefront. So,
right.
so it's a disservice to Trey, if you will, but ultimately, you know, still a great track. And yeah, I do kind of wish they would have ended with this one.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think so too. Cause, you know, once you get to Just a Man, I mean, I can't decide if like the gospel style vocals, if we had gotten rid of a couple of the other tracks and this was the last track, like, would it have sort of been like a nice touch, or would it have just been just odd, you know?
Yeah, I'm gonna lean towards it's odd regardless.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it's a weird ballad, and he's almost acting like a crooner in this one, you know, like an old time,
yeah.
you know, almost Sinatra like, you know, and gospel like you mentioned. It's an out there track, and you know, don't get me wrong, I love Faith No More's more out there tracks, but even this one leaves me scratching my head a little bit.
It's funny because when he starts really, like you said, crooning near the end there, it kind of reminded me of The Great Gig in the Sky off of the, you know, the Dark Side of the Moon. Like,
okay, yeah.
But I mean, you know, that in that case, you know, obviously I think that vocal actually worked, you know, surprisingly as that was, like, sort of coming out of nowhere on that album. But
mm-hmm.
but it just kind of like, yeah, like he comes off, I think, in this track once he starts crooning like that, it just comes off as goofy. Like,
yeah, I kind of felt the same way about that Bee Gees cover that they did. I didn't feel as strongly
right, yeah.
about it. I forgot the name of that track. That,
oh, God, yeah.
Oh, I started a joke.
Yes.
Yeah, yep. That was the first time I heard that. I'm like, really? That's what
yeah.
you're giving me? But, you know, I didn't even realize it was a cover the first time I heard it. So, I, you know,
yeah.
I'm sitting here thinking it's an original Faith No More track, and I'm like, wow, why don't I like this?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how
you're
I felt with Just a Man going into it. It's like, I should like this more, and for some reason I don't, and I don't know why.
That's the thing. It's like, Patton just, it's like, with the drama and the theatrics, it's like it either, you know, it works, and I'd say it works, you know, most of the time, but it just, like, if, you know, there's times when he just totally misses the mark, you know, and I think this track is a good example of that. Like, it's just such an odd juxtaposition of, like, the sort of nice-sounding, you know, gospel vocals, and then
mm-hmm.
him just getting very strange, you know, over it. And for it to go out, like, on that note is just strange. It's like you get this weird sort of image. It's like one of those movies where you're supposed to feel good at the end, but but it just seems very, very odd and surreal, you know.
Yeah, you're more confused than anything else.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So like I said, yeah, I do have that issue with the end. Couple little sequencing issues. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they could have structured the album a little bit differently to maximize the effect and everything. But as far as the material itself, I mean, there's very few tracks that I would say, oh, you know, that was a mistake. They should have left that off the album. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's almost all worthwhile. So.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't consider any track on this album a filler or throwaway track, though. You know, mm-hmm. we've discussed Just a Man, and like I said, it easily could have been left off the album, and I still would love the album just as much. But mm-hmm. I don't necessarily regret their decision necessarily to put it in there. Mm-hmm. I wish it would have been just like more of a bonus track than an actual track on the album. Secret track, yeah. Maybe something like that. But yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to say it brings down the album. I mean, I still rate it very high. Obviously, it's my favorite Faith No More album. And, you know, between the production value, Mike Patton's lyrics, Mike Patton's vocals, you know, I can't say enough good things about the album. And yeah, I mean, I would rate this fairly high. Not perfect by any stretch, but mm-hmm. pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually, with this one, I came in at a 6 out of 10. I was like kind of right there with the Spin score. Mm-hmm. You know, I definitely wouldn't look at it as harshly as some of the other publications or whatever had.
Sure. Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I come in, you know, obviously being that it's my favorite album from one of my favorite mm-hmm. bands, you know, I come in around 8.5 for this one. Mm-hmm. you know, cause I had Angel Dust at right around 8. So, you know, liking this one slightly more than Angel Dust, I'd probably go 8.5 on this one.
Mm-hmm. What did you think? Actually, I wanted to ask you this before and I forgot to, what did you think of the album they released? I think it was 2 years ago now. I think that album Soul Invictus.
Oh God. I haven't even heard the entire thing yet. Believe it or not. I bought it. Uh-huh. I just have not got, I actually bought it very late. I didn't buy it when it first came out. I actually didn't know it was even coming out. It's a terrible thing for me to say considering how much music meant to me as a youngster, you know, in the 80s and 90s. But unfortunately, uh-huh. I don't really follow these bands as much as I used to. Like I'm not, you know, on websites, you know, looking for release yeah. dates and things like that. I remember the mm-hmm. first track dropped and I heard it and I liked it. Then I went out and bought it, probably listened to the first 3 or 4 tracks multiple times, but then, you know, just mm-hmm. got distracted with one thing or another. So I do enjoy what I heard off it. I don't feel mm-hmm. like it's their strongest effort by any stretch, but you know, just like we said with Dead Cross, you know, you're talking 50 plus year old men trying to sound like 20 year olds, you know?
Right. Yeah. As far as, Soul Invictus goes, like for me, I like it. It's funny because, you know, whereas, you know, King for a Day, something like King for a Day pushes, you know, like an hour long, basically it's like 57 minutes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you look at Soul Invictus, which, I'm pretty sure it's right around the 40 minute mark, I think.
Yeah, it's a short one.
Which seems to be a trend now. It seems like bands are like sort of getting into this mode where like albums are like between 40 and 45 yeah. minutes now, which I don't really have a problem with because I feel like I can actually listen to that in one sitting, like
sure, sure, absolutely,
without you know getting distracted or falling asleep or like you were saying, trying to listen to stuff in the car. It's like it's a perfect length. So
yeah,
I'm getting so used to that then sometimes albums like King for a Day sort of like seem very long to me, which is just funny because it's like, you know, back in when that album came out, it was like I feel like that was more the norm. You know, it was like bands were trying to pack more, you know, into the albums to sort of
yeah.
I guess give you your money's worth or whatever.
Exactly. But, I mean, I remember in the early 80s, a lot of metal bands doing like very short albums, you know, bands like Slayer yeah. just doing like, you yeah. know, 30, 40 minute epics and, you know, mm-hmm. but then probably, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Metallica was one of the first bands that I remember actually starting to do more, you know, 6, 8, 10 minute tracks, you know, epic,
right,
you know,
right, yeah,
arrangements that, you know, kind of blew you away. And yeah, they kind of set the standard for, as you said, moving into the 90s, people were doing longer albums, throwing more tracks on there. I don't know if that was a, you know, get your money's worth type situation, but yeah, I definitely felt like the music kind of suffered because, you know, especially if you're, if you have pressure from a record label to do 12 tracks and you've got nine good ones, it's like, wouldn't you rather, I don't know. I'm not sure what the mentality is there. I've never run a record label before, but yeah, I feel like some bands that were forced to do 10 plus track albums kind of suffered for it. And that's too bad.
Yeah. All right. Well, that just about wraps it up. Jared, this was awesome, man. I'm really glad that you were able to come on. Thank you for doing this. And why don't you, you know, I wanted to mention this earlier, and I did. Why don't you let the listeners know a little bit about, you know, the Rad Radio podcast and even the Horrorcast too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Want to plug those? Yeah.
Definitely. First and foremost, thank you very much for having me on. This was great. Like I said, my first music podcast experience, and the fact that we were able to discuss one of my favorite albums ever made it a lot easier. And you know,
I'm glad.
I mean, I can honestly tell you, I took more notes for this podcast than I have for any of the 3 to 4 hour podcasts that I do on my other shows. So yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity. This was
sure. Great.
Anyway, back to my other podcasts. I am a full-time host on Rad Radio, the All 80s podcast, with some great co-hosts there. We've got Marky McFly, who you might also know as Mark Nato from the Horrorcast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mike, Tammy, and, we actually are going to be introducing a new co-host on our next episode, Secret. It's actually, he's an established guy that, some people probably already know very well, especially in the Horrorphilia Network. So you'll be hearing about that very soon. And like I said, we put out 2 episodes, a month, you know, every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. We try to discuss, you know, anything 80s related, be it movies, TV shows, video games, comic books, whatever the case may be, we're going to cover the gamut of it all. You know, we're up to, let's see, we just recorded episode 8, I believe, 8 or 9, which was our Karate Kid and Crossroads retrospective, which, it got kind of heated because, unfortunately, this is one of those movies that I absolutely loved early, you know, when I first saw it, and then I kind of I hadn't seen it for a good 20-25 years, and then watching it for the podcast, you know, it's like, wow, I can't believe I loved this back then. Not that it's a terrible movie. You know, it's actually Mark Nato's one of his favorite movies ever, so you know, we have a nice little back and forth about why I disliked it and why he loves it. So yeah, a great little podcast that, you know, I'm very happy to be a part of. Obviously, I'm old enough that I lived through the 80s. I remember it all very well. The drugs haven't killed my entire memory yet. And so yeah, that's the Rad Radio podcast. And then I'm also a fill-in host on the Horrorcast, which is on the Phantom Podcast Network. Again, obviously, it is a horror movie podcast where we discuss an older movie and a newer movie. We're also in the middle right now of a the drive-in series, the Horrorcast drive-in, where we're kind of discussing movies from like the 50s and 60s that are, you know, creature features that are more associated with the drive-in from, you know, from back in the day. The next episode that we're doing with that is going to be more about aliens. The first episode we did, we discussed them and the Blob, so, you know, traditional creature features. Now we're going to be moving into more alien-type stuff with The Thing from Another World and the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, so that should be a good episode. Look for that one in the next week or two. And and then, you know, like I said, you can hear me on various podcasts doing guest spots. You know, I've been on Evil episodes with Mike Merriman. I will be on an episode of Cut to the Chase with Dan Chase and Mike Merriman again in the near future. And yeah, I I've only been podcasting for about a year, but I am absolutely addicted. So any time I can get a guest spot, I jump at it. And, you know, like I said, this was a great opportunity here to hopefully get my voice out to more people. And, you know, and hopefully I was able to interject some useful tidbits to your show.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I think it was a blast. So I'm glad to, you know, we got a little bit more, music review exposure, you know, for you.
Oh, yeah.
So glad that we did that. I would love to do it again. So.
Oh, definitely. I'm always open to it.
All right, cool.
All right.
Well, that concludes the main event segment for this episode of Radio Live Transmission. I'm your host, Ryan. Thank you guys for listening, and have a good night.